Today I just want to finish talking about interferometers. So there's a lot of interesting two-particle interferometers, which I'm not going to go into in depth, but if you're interested in this, I really recommend you spend some time studying them. So I just sort of basically finished yesterday or Monday's lecture by talking about two-particle interferometers. And then I'm going to move on to the measurement problem in quantum theory. So, sometimes when you see lists of the most significant problems in physics, the measurement problem will appear on that list. And sometimes it doesn't. It depends really on your attitude. So I'll talk about that. And then if I get time, I'll talk about the quantum Zeno effect. We just finished talking about interferometry. So two particles. Obviously, you can also consider three particles and four particles and so on, but let's just restrict ourselves to one and two particles. So for two-particle interference, well, really the thing that differs is you need a you now need two particles, and you could have a source which is just two separate sources. Let's call this one R, see. So for two different particles, like that, and then you can send these into an interferometer and so on. Well, one example is something which I proposed back in 1992, and it was based on the Elitzur-Weidman bomb problem. So using this kind of source. Let me just draw that. I'm not going to go into this in detail. I just draw the picture, and you can think about it if you want. You have an interferometer here, and into this one you send a positron. Then you have another interferometer here. And into this one you send an electron. Another button you press. So you press these two buttons at the same time. Release an electron which goes into this interferometer and a positron which goes into this interferometer and an electron which goes into this one. And you imagine that if they meet at this point here, then they annihilate. So what's effectively happening here is you've got the Elitzur-Weidman bomb problem. You could think of this as an interferometer that you use to see which way this particle goes. And so if I just label these detectors, this is C, this is T. So in the absence of this interferometer, this positron will be detected here always. So you know that if the positron is detected here, then you can reason that the electron must have been gone along this path, and so that means that if you were to put a detector in here, this detector would fire. Okay. If you don't have a detector inside here, instead you have a detector inside here, then just by symmetry, you can reason that if this detector fires, then the positron must have gone this way. This way. If you have a detector both here and here, then you know that. You know that it's impossible for this detector to fire and also for this one to fire, because the only way that could happen is if the electron passes through here and the positron passes through this point, but they would annihilate. So it's impossible for these two detectors to fire. Okay, is this clear so far? You can everything I'm saying you can back up by a proper calculation. I'm just using words to save time. And then finally, if you have no detectors in here, and this detector fires, well, you know this electron is here. So when it gets to this path, it's no longer interfering, so it could go this way or this way. Possible it goes here. So that's something that could happen. Okay. So we have these four predictions. Each of them correspond to a different situation. So the first one is where you have no detectors inside these U paths. The second one is where you have a detector just inside the U minus path. The third one, a detector just inside the U plus path. And the last one is where you have detectors in both these paths. And if you look at those results, they look counterintuitive, because if you think of these as revealing properties, then you would say, well, d plus and d minus can happen sometimes, but if d plus happens, we know we'd have u minus, and if d minus happens, we know we'd have u plus. So it seems like we should have, in at least these cases, we should have u minus and u plus simultaneously, and yet we know u plus and u minus can never happen at the same time. So it looks like we have a contradiction. Also, intuitively, if you just think about what's happening, if you think in terms of a picture of particles that are traveling along through this interferometer, then if you have d plus, you would reason that the electron must be going this way, because you have d plus, and so the electron should be inside here. And if you have d minus, you would reason that the positron going this way. So when you have d plus and d minus, it seems like the electrons have to pass through this point. And yet we know that's not possible. So you can spend time thinking about this situation. In the end, what it amounts to is proof of that quantum theory cannot be explained in local hidden variable terms. Have you done Bell's theorem in any courses? You have. You did that in the quantum course. Okay, so this is an alternative proof of Bell's theorem. Okay. Yep, go ahead.
Example for D plus, you mean it can only positron?
Which one, sorry?
For example, for the detector D plus, do you
Yeah.
mean it only can detect positron, or?
Yeah, so we're imagining that this is the positron interferometer, and this is the electron interferometer. And they're separate, except that if the two particles meet here, then they will annihilate.
I mean, the detector is designed in this way that only detects.
Well, just the way it's being configured, in any case, the electron will never arrive here. But let's say yes. I mean, we can imagine that this detector only detects positrons. The detectors that have a plus on them are purpose-built to detect positrons, and the ones that have a minus are built to detect electrons. Any more questions? Yeah, go ahead.
What if the photon naturally breaks again into the electron and the positron?
Oh, right. So you want to have... So what I've done here is I've made a sort of an assumption that this process of annihilation happens with 100% efficiency, which would be very difficult to achieve in principle. I mean, the kind of process you're talking about would be some very low probability process, and it would affect slightly these predictions. So from a Gedanken point of view, you can certainly arrange that you have you can have a unitary transformation that does what I'm saying. But for real electrons and protons, you would have higher order effects that would interfere with this a little bit. There's a way of setting this up using quantum optics instead. What you do then is you have two photons going in here, and you put a beam splitter in here. That beam splitter here. And you send the photons in at the same time. There's an interesting effect in quantum optics. If you send two photons onto a beam splitter, let me just represent it by a... Obviously, there's not really particles, but then what happens is both photons will come out the same side, the beam splitter, either the left or the right. And that has to do with the fact that these are bosons. I'm hoping to show you how that works in the future. So if you did that, then either both photons will come out one way or the other. And if you're just interested in detecting one photon, then effectively these cases where there's two photons in one of the interferometers are not being considered. So this is an alternative way to implement. This process is very high efficiency. So it's interesting that you can get two photons to kind of interact inside a beam splitter like this. There's work showing that you can use beam splitters. Because of this, you can use beam splitters and photons to do universal quantum computing. It's a very strong interaction. But yeah, the answer is this is really a Gedanken experiment. They use the word Gedanken a lot. Thought means thought in German. Okay, let me. There's another interferometer. Two particles, which I think is interesting. And this is now where you have a source like this. So the source, what it does is it emits pairs of particles. Either the particles go out this direction, back to back, or they go at this direction. So we have A and A prime and B prime. So we have either the unprimed particle over here or the prime particle. So you could imagine making this happen by momentum conservation. Particles go out back to back. There's a way of doing this in quantum optics using what's called parametric down conversion. Okay, so in this case, what's interesting is to take these two cases and interfere them. Thank you. like so. And well, in this case, if you just look at what happens on one side of the experiment, say the left-hand side over here, and you vary the phase, and you ignore what's happening on the other side, then you won't see any interference. And that has to be the case because you could always make a measurement over here to see where this particle is, and that will tell you which path this particle was taking inside the interferometer. So you can't have any local interference here. Vary this phase. And the same is true over here. If you ignore what's happening on the left-hand side and you vary this phase, then you won't see an interference. However, if you look at the joint probabilities, say, detecting at D and D prime or D and C prime and so on, if you look at those joint probabilities and you vary the phase, then you will see interference. This is two-particle interference. So what happens is that the interference will be a function of you'll get some sinusoidal dependence on the sum of those two phases. And this is an interesting experiment. This experiment was done back in the 1980s by Rarity and Tapster. And it's a way of this experiment will violate Bell inequalities. Actually, the 1990s. Early 1990s. It's an interesting experiment to think about. Any questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Particles which are sent out are entangled, or
I should have. They go back to back, so the state will be like this. And there's some phase, but just assume the phase is zero. So if you take that state and then do the kinds of manipulations I showed you on Monday, where you evolve this through beam splitters on both sides, then you'll see this sinusoidal dependence on the sum of the two phases. You can kind of see that you'll get e to the i phi coming in front of here, e to the i a phi coming in front here, and an e to the I phi a prime coming in front here as well. So you'll get the two phases adding, and then when you do the calculation, you'll get. I'm not going to do that, but if you have a spare 15 minutes on your hands, it's interesting to go through that. Any questions?
Can you just briefly sketch, when you talk about how to violate the Bell inequality, how do you like take into account like the effect of some hidden variable in any of these experiments?
Okay, so I think if I'm going to start talking about hidden variables, then that's kind of a lecture in itself, which I will talk about hidden variables later, although I think I'd like to look at what you've done on Bell's theorem. So I'll if anyone knows what lecture it was, do you know which lecture it was?
Oh, we did it in PSI, but I think we can move to
the you've done it in, you haven't done it in PSI? Oh, okay, right, but you just happen to have come across it in your own. Okay, then I should cover Bell's theorem. When I give this course, in previous times, people have done Bell's theorem in depth in a previous course, but that's not the case. Okay, so I should cover Bell's theorem, and I'll do that in a future lecture.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So that's let's move on to the measurement problem. Before I talk about the measurement problem, I want to present just a set of axioms for quantum theory. And you know, if you open a textbook on quantum theory, then generally you'll have a set of axioms or postulates that tell you what the theory is about. And there's small variations between these sets of axioms, but they all basically say the same thing. Although there is a distinction, I think, between setting up the axioms in quantum theory for pure states and setting them up for mixed states. If you set the axioms up for mixed states, then you have what look like different axioms. And personally, I think that's a more interesting case. But right now, I'm going to give you the axioms quantum theory in terms of pure states. So so you have to imagine these axioms being engraved on stone and handed down to us by the gods. Associated with each system, I'm going to denote systems by A, B, C, etc., by lowercase letters. Is a Hilbert space, H A sub 1. The A indicates the type of system, and the integer here, be 1, 2, 3, etc., indicates the particular instance of that system. You may have more than one copy of a given type of system, like an electron or a photon or whatever. And that Hilbert space is of some dimension, n sub a. Dimension of the Hilbert space depends on the type of system, but not the particular instance. Of course, any system of a given type will have a Hilbert space of the same dimension. I notice already that the notation I was using previously is not consistent with this. I should have, instead of using a prime, should have used A1 and A2 in the previous, just if I was to be inconsistent. And I'm going to deal with the case where n is finite dimensional. You could take this to be an infinite dimensional. But in all the examples I'll look at, this will be finite. Okay. Axiom 2.
Sorry, what's the last part of the sentence?
Where A is the system type and 1 is the instance. Is that what you were asking, Attica?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so axiom 2. For composite system, So for example, A1, A2, B, B, C, 4. There's an example of a composite system. The Hilbert space is given by the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces for each of the components. So in the particular example we have here, it would be this. Okay, any questions? State of a system, if it's a composite system the state of a system is pure. Sorry, state of a system at a given time t. Okay, so if you've got some system you're considering, this could be some big composite system, then the state of that system is given by an element of the Hilbert space. Evolution. So the axioms so far are fairly straightforward. With axioms 4 and 5, things start to get a bit weird, I would say, and especially by the time you get to axiom 5. So evolution, there's two cases. When there's no measurement, the state evolves unitarily. So So, and the Schrodinger equation is an instance of this. Here I've just given you the evolution over some finite time. And B is when there is a measurement. Well, then the state is projected with the projector that's associated with the measurement outcome. So what that means is the state goes from that to that. Okay. Yep.
Is there any reason why we separate the two cases? Because maybe we can include measurement with the entry evolution of the book.
Yeah, so that will be so I'm going to discuss the measurement problem next, and that's something we can talk about. And there's different attitudes people take. So yeah, we'll go into that exact question in a lot of depth. Do you have a question?
Is the projecting of a state with a projector, like, can you think about it as equivalently to like collapsing of a state or like?
Yeah, so what I'd like to do is to use the word project just to think about the mathematical process, whereas collapse to think about something that might be a physical process, because you can distinguish between the two cases. So projection is something you might do for mathematical convenience, whereas a collapse, you think of actually the physical state, you know, in the world changing as a consequence of the measurement. And I'll talk about that a bit.
So we can distinguish between these two different.
So projection is sort of, with the word project, we can try to remain neutral as to whether this is just a mathematical convenience or something that actually happens. And then with the word collapse, we can not be neutral about that and say, actually, this is something that actually happens. Okay, and then the last axiom, axiom 5. Usually in systems of axioms, you want to have 5 axioms and you want axiom 5 to be the one that everyone questions, at least going back to Euclid. Here, I think already some of the issues are creeping into axiom 4. This is already obviously not a very satisfactory axiom. But let me write down axiom 5. Best way to do this. I'll just take this one up. Stop. Yeah. There. Good. Now I'll raise this. Yeah, go ahead.
When we're thinking about like project and like measurement in terms of projectors, does it do we always think about it as an instantaneous process?
Yeah, that's another good question. Um, And this is really the reason I prefer the axiomatized quantum theory in terms of mixed states instead of pure states. Because then you can really, then you have a bigger set of available transformations. So at one extreme, you have unitary evolution for mixed states. And the other extreme, you have instantaneous projection. But then you also have what a completely positive maps, which is a more general set of transformations, which contains the two special cases I just mentioned. And what those will do is allow you to over time go from a state which is, you know, go over time to something which looks like a projection, but it will take some amount of time. So I think if you really want to study that properly, you should do it that way. But another point of view, and I think it also depends on how you resolve the measurement problem I'm going to talk about. How you should think about that. So yeah, so it's a good question, but I it kind of depends on the conceptual and mathematical machinery I haven't put in place yet. Okay. So axiom five. The probability after a measurement outcome is given by the square modulus of the amplitude in front of the state after projection. And you can write that down like this. You know, your state after projection is this. And then if you want to find the square modulus, you take the conjugate of that, multiply together. And that's just equal to this. Because this is a projection operator, the square of the projection operator is just equal to itself. This is sometimes referred to as the Born rule. In the literature. Okay. I'm trying to think what is weird about this. Well, one thing that's weird is now suddenly probability is coming into physics in a fundamental way. And you know, if you ever have time on your hands, I realize I'm saying this a lot. If you ever have even more time on your hands, then you know, I suggest picking up a book on the philosophy of probability. It's an interesting subject, and there's all sorts of attempts to make proper scientific sense of the notion of probability from a philosophical point of view. So it is, I would say, quite problematic that you have probability appearing fundamentally in the equations of. So that's one issue, and then another issue is. It really connects in with what was happening here, that you have this measurement and state, and now you're extracting a probability from it. But one technical issue I should mention is in this 4b, I projected the state. I didn't renormalize it. And the reason I didn't renormalize it is because then the amplitude associated with that state gives you the probability directly. Now people in the textbooks, people will often renormalize the state by dividing it by an appropriate normalization factor. And you can do that if you want, but then you're throwing away some information. It's really a matter of whether you're interested in calculating joint probabilities in the long run or conditional probabilities. And if you have conditional probabilities, if you have joint probabilities, you can always use those to calculate conditional probabilities mathematically. So it's easier, I think it's better to keep the information in and not normalize this thing after a measurement. Okay. Right, how am I doing? Yep, go ahead.
Don't you need a form of a Schrodinger equation in the list of your axioms?
So the Schrodinger's equation appears in 4a. It's sort of, I've given it effectively in integral form, where I am integrating over some finite duration of time. But that's really where the Schrodinger equation appears. So the unitary evolution is given by is given by a Hamiltonian.
Asking the same question in another way, like should we assume the way that unitary evolution is dependent on Hamiltonian of the system, or it can be?
So personally, I think the more abstract way of thinking is that you've just got some unitary evolution, and then you can generate that unitary evolution by a Hamiltonian, which is really a piece of mathematics. But of course, if you want to study a particular physical system, then usually you write down a Hamiltonian. That's how you get traction. So just there's the case for abstraction generally in physics is often it's better to discover discuss the most general situation and then apply it to particular instances. Go ahead.
Can you also derive an uncertainty principle from the axioms?
I know why she's laughing. It's because one of my favorite textbooks is written by Asher Peres, and Asher Peres was not a fan of the uncertainty principle. So if you look in the contents at the back, the index at the back of his book, and you go to where it says uncertainty principle, and then it has a certain page number 451, I think. And then you look to the top of that very same page, that's the page number. And his point was that the uncertainty principle isn't really a principle, it's a derived fact from quantum theory. It's not one of the axioms of quantum theory, but just a derived fact from these axioms.
I can see there's algebra, operator algebra in this.
Like from superposition, maybe?
Yeah, I haven't put in an operator algebra. This is kind of a Schrodinger picture point of view, and you can get all the physics you need out of this. If you want to go to some quantum field theory or something like that, often we use those devices. But in terms of basic abstract quantum theory, this gives you what you need. The place where it's deficient is, in my opinion, is that it doesn't deal with mixed states, and that's interesting. Okay, so I have 10 and a half minutes to discuss the measurement problem. Let's see how I do. So this may need to spill over into the next lecture. So my notes suddenly become very dense when I discuss the measurement problem because I keep adding to it and trying to make it more precise. So let me see if I can decipher what I've written here. Okay. The measurement, you should probably come with a health warning. In the sense that, you know, if you can go go insane. going down this is kind of a rabbit hole that can drive you crazy. I think there are documented cases of this actually. So, on the other hand, it's important for your education in physics to know about this. You said physics wasn't a dangerous subject. Okay. So let's consider again the case we looked at on Monday, where we had a source. Very simple situation. I have, what was my notation? A, B. I think it was A and B. Doesn't matter. Okay, we have some detectors A and B. Okay. So the initial state is that some particles been emitted. Now we evolve it through the beam splitter. Both these detectors are in the ready state, and now we evolve it past that. So now either A clicks or B stays in the ready state, or B clicks. And A stays in the ready state. Okay. So now if you follow what I said here, now you have an actual measurement outcome. So you see either A clicks or B clicks. Imagine, for example, that it's A that clicks. Then the state becomes this. And so you project. And then the probability is the modulus squared of this. So you get the probability equal to half. So the measurement problem. It's really a dilemma. You get caught on the horns of a dilemma depending on how you want to think about this. Either you say, well, this projection isn't really something that happens, okay? So the real physical state of the universe is this, okay? So you have no collapse. Maybe this is a mathematical trick, but the real state of the universe is this. And then you have the reality problem. Because if the real state of the universe is this, there seems to be a discrepancy between this state of the universe and what we actually experience. Because what we actually experience is seeing one detector click or the other. If we don't no claps. Thank you. Okay. So the term reality problem was coined by Philip Pearl. You have this discrepancy between two different ways, the way we experience reality, something actually happens, and the quantum state. If you're on this horn of the dilemma, if you decide you don't want to have actual collapse, and this seems reasonable because I think as was commented earlier, it seems very unnatural to have this second thing. Surely you should just make all evolution unitary. That seems to be what quantum theory wants to do. So if you do this, then how do you resolve this problem? And there are two different techniques in the literature. So one is to say, really there's three. Let me come to the third as well. There's the two main techniques in the literature are to say, well, one is to say, well, this state here isn't the complete story. There's some additional hidden variables. And those hidden variables tell you that you have either this or this. So in the case of the de Broglie-Bohm model, you have the wave function. The wave function evolves unitarily if it collapses. But there's some additional hidden variables that tell you that the actual particle positions are in one of these two terms. Okay. And I'll discuss the de Broglie-Bohm model in a later lecture. So resolution. The de Broglie-Bohm model is an example of that. Or you might say, well, no, I don't like that because that's adding extra physics that I can't really that go beyond this sort of beautiful theory. So you could say, no, this is the full story. Everything is in here. In that case, the approach is the many worlds approach. And in the many worlds approach, what you have to do is make sense of the idea that although the state of the universe is this, what we actually experience if we're inside the universe like this is definite events. And you do that by imagining some kind of splitting into different worlds, which I described that. So typically what you'll do then is you'll also include yourself in here, or let's say me. So there's me, and then after this evolution, I also get entangled. So either I see the A detector click, or I see B click. And so you have to think about now. Not only did the detector go into a superposition, but also I went into this superposition. And you have to argue that in this case you'll only experience one result, even though both results actually happen. So we'll talk about that when it was interpretation in a later lecture. The third option, which I suddenly remembered, was you can deny that you should regard this as the state of the universe. Okay, this is not a real thing. Okay. as. And then you get into interpretations like, well, there's the Copenhagen interpretation due to Niels Bohr, which is really difficult to understand. But sometimes it's taken to mean something like this. There's the cubist approach, which I think also fits into this. So Copenhagen. Cubism, I should say. So this is Cuban's approach is due to Chris Fuchs and his collaborators. So you know, that's broadly. So that's if you're on the first horn of the dilemma. And I see I'm out of time. So the next lecture, which has been rescheduled. Okay, so Friday there's this big announcement, and so everyone's supposed to be in the atrium for that big announcement. So the next lecture will actually be on Monday, and then I'll do a makeup lecture on, I think it's, have you been told about this? I think it's on Thursday at, I forget the time, it should be on you. Okay, 12:45, yeah. I will have office hours on Friday. So my office is 4:59. It's if you haven't, sometimes people get lost trying to find 4:59. That should be sufficient information for you to find it. So yeah, you had a question.
It doesn't seem that the problem is related.
Oh, so that's something I did. Sorry.
It seems like the reality problem is not related to the measurement, but by the fact that the photon after going through the beam splitter is written as a superposition. Why can't we just is that the right thing to do? I mean, it's either here or here, right? We're writing it as a superposition of it being on both sides of the.
I mean, so you think about it being in spatially different places. So you could imagine. Okay, has a mind of its own.
Detectors in one of the paths and stuff. For a more complicated systems, you'll actually affect them. Detectors. So you need to consider the whole wave function in order to properly calculate the outcomes. Okay, sure. It's a little hot.
It's getting its exercise in.
we shouldn't be talking about the measurement problem. I think that's the upshot. There is, I think there's something, there's a kernel of truth in what you're saying, which is there's a question, is position special when it comes to the measurement problem of understanding quantum theory? So you might have an example where instead of where your quantum system isn't in a superposition of being in different places, it's something where you just measure some internal degree of freedom. Like, I'm not sure why this is doing this. Okay, well, I did accidentally touch part of the screen and now it's going crazy. So you could have a system where you have a spin half particle, it comes in, you perform a measurement of the spin, or some other, where you have an internal degree of freedom for the system. But at some point, if you have a detector click or whatever, something macroscopic, you will end up having two distinct situations, which are distinct in position space. So one, you might have a pointer, which is coupled to the system, and the pointer either points here or here. So then it's not the microscopic level, but it's at the macroscopic level you get this different position. So people ask, you know, is position important for understanding the measurement problem? So that's something you can think about, and there's some interesting mathematical results, you can try and prove it along in that direction.
Also, superposition is not one of the axioms.
I mean, superposition is in here because any Hilbert space, if it has dimension nA greater than 1, then you allow the state to be an element of Hilbert space. Then that includes states which have a superposition over some basis. So that's where you get superposition from in these axioms. Yeah. Okay.
Can I ask something else about this reality problem? Why we cannot just take the full state of the system as granted and tell that like this is the reality and any measurement can just discover part of the reality? Like I don't see why it's even a problem. Why we cannot just treat the full state of the system as reality and just treat this collapse that we get from like measurement as something just saying that no measurement can give us the full knowledge about the state of the system.
I think. You can just a few seconds before it goes down again. You can you can do something like that. I think that basically leads you to the many worlds approach. So in a sense, whatever attitude you take, you end up taking a philosophical position. I think effectively taking a philosophical position. So if you say, well, that is the full state, then still it's going to be the case that I'll get things like this. You know, I will have myself inside the state at some point, coupled, entangled with other stuff, and so you have to make sense of that. So I think you end up having to make sense of it one way or the other.
I guess we're not okay with probabilistic reality. Like reality doesn't exist before any measurement.
So then you're sort of going along this direction, I think. You're saying the state is not a real thing. It's just the state doesn't describe reality as such. It's some thing like that. So you can try to pursue that approach if you like. But philosophically, it's hard, I think, to only have outcomes of measurements as the real things, because are those outcomes of measurements according to you, according to any person? Are they outcomes of measurements? What is it that this is going to be the second horn of the dilemma? Who gets to say what are the real things in that case, or do you just give up on reality entirely? That's also problematic. So maybe that's a good place to stop, because I am going to talk about the second horn, the dilemma, on Monday.